Gottlieb, Parshas Shemos, December 31st, 2005.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. This is maybe his third time, I don't recall. I'm not counting anymore, because now it's a chazaka, and it's our pleasure to hear.
This is actually the second time. We'll just see how it goes, and then we can determine
whether
there'll be a chazaka or not.
Without further ado, Rabbi Gottlieb. Let's see.
Thank you so much, Howie. When I volunteered for tonight, I don't think I fully realized that I was going to get the graveyard shift of evenings here. But as it turns out, really a grosser yasher koach to all of you for coming out. I know you have other choices, and pardon? Those come later. Okay, you could efshir l'chaim shneim. You know, we could do both, but. In all seriousness, tonight is New Year's Eve of 2016, and whatever the halachic status of the secular New Year is, it's clear that we are ushering in not just a new year in the secular calendar, but it's a election year. We're in the midst, really, of an election cycle, but 2016 formally ushers in the election year with all eyes towards November and the presidential election. And in light of that fact, which kind of looms large for those of us who like to read the news and get caught up in the political fray, I think it's important to acknowledge that politics of modernity, the politics that we're familiar with in the early 21st century, has the kind of feel of sloganeering and sound bites, and sometimes you're not even sure if what you're watching is a presidential debate or a Saturday Night Live skit. You're not sure which one is which. And we could laugh about it, and it is funny. Some of it is funny, but it's also deadly serious. And the fact that the state of political discourse today is so low and is so full of sound bites and sloganeering, we sometimes forget that politics once occupied a much more elevated view in the eyes of philosophers and thinkers from the West, but also, to a certain extent, the Jewish tradition, our own Masorah. And I think it's worthwhile dwelling on that fact for a minute or two, because we tend to be very cynical about our politicians, and for good cause. And, you know, again, we don't have to name names, but you know, we look at it's a very interesting field. The Republican field is very interesting. Probably less so the Democratic field, and that's not a partisan claim, but in terms of just how wacky and how sort of interesting and bizarre, you know, there's lots going on. But it's important to remember that politics wasn't always such. Yes, let's not be romantic or naive about politics ever transcending the world of muckraking and lowball accusations. That's always been the case. But there was a time, even in American history, let alone in classical history, where the occupation of the politician, the very enterprise and the vocation of political life was one that was held in very high esteem. You don't have to go back to Aristotle, but it's worthwhile actually pointing out the fact that Aristotle defines politics as the art of the possible. That politics is not just about partisan debates. It's not just about getting one's own party or one's own faction or one's own sect in the ascendancy, but it's about developing a polity, a community, that will aim towards human flourishing, that will aim towards the advancement of humanity, the advancement of your people. The American founding fathers were politicians, that they had their share of debates. I mean, Jefferson and Adams and, you know, many, many more were Burke and Payne. There were many ugly debates, but they thought they were engaged in something lofty, in something rarefied. And it's very interesting, if you go back in American history, the Jewish people are invoked as a kind of model for a healthy polity. And before the American seal, the great seal of America, the eagle and the shield and the arrows that we're all familiar with, looking at coins, looking at Americana, before that was ratified as the official symbol of the United States, does anyone know what symbol was being considered by Jefferson and Franklin as the great seal of the United States of America? Pardon? Urim v'Tumim. That's Yale's motto, actually. Not the Aseret HaDibros, but close. We're in the right parsha. We're in the right sefer. The Jewish people crossing the Red Sea. And the Anone HaKavod, the trailing clouds of glory, protecting the Jewish people. And you can see the iconography from a visual and a conceptual point of view. What is the children of Israel leaving, fleeing Egypt, and crossing the Red Sea under divine providence? It's a metaphor for the Americans. It's a metaphor for the American colonists rebelling against a tyrannical king, not, you know, Pharaoh, but King George III. And with providence and the great stretch of the Atlantic Ocean, the bounty that was America and the colonies, this is providence pointing to the fact that the colonists will be free. They will receive their liberty, their freedom. And that was an actual image that the original colonists and the founding fathers especially had, you know, imbued or embedded in their minds when they thought about their own narrative, their own story. And fast forward, if you want to look at another political use of Moshe Rabbeinu, the civil rights movement. Think about how the civil rights movement invoked the image of Moses and let my people go. Because there was something resonant about Moshe Rabbeinu as not just as a religious figure, but a political figure. We Jews tend to think of Moshe Rabbeinu in purely religious terms, right? Moshe Rabbeinu is the Adon Kol HaNavim, he's the prince of all prophets. According to the Rambam, his prophecy is the highest form of prophecy possible. He is the vehicle in which the Torah is delivered to mankind, to the Jewish people. As Jews, we tend to think of Moshe Rabbeinu in religious categories. But there is good cause to think of Moshe Rabbeinu in political categories as well. In fact, there was a book by a journalist, an American journalist by the name of Bruce Feiler. Feiler wrote a book about walking through Israel and living the Bible. And a sequel to that book was called America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story. Because Moshe, in both popular culture and in political culture, has this kind of political significance, has this kind of political meaning. And I wanted to take a few minutes with you this evening to trace some of these political dimensions of Moshe Rabbeinu's career. And I want to focus especially on what I'm calling the political education of Moshe Rabbeinu. I want to focus in Parshas Shmos on the youth and early life of Moshe Rabbeinu as a kind of key to understanding a broader and deeper sense of what politics means, and hopefully recovering this more rarefied or more elevated, almost Aristotelian notion of politics being the art of the possible, so that we're not stuck in thinking about politics as just muckraking or sloganeering or soundbiting. So let's just think about Bereishis as a sefer as a whole and its transition to Sefer Shmos, this week's parsha. So if you had to whittle down Sefer Bereishis into one or two words, into a pithy little formula, what is Sefer Bereishis about and what is Sefer Shmos about? I mean, there are lots of answers here. It's hard to get this wrong. But if you had to think about the relationship between Sefer Bereishis and Sefer Shmos. Okay, so selection, right? And the birth of a nation. Both of those are very resonant because selection, Sefer Bereishis, is essentially the story of a family that is selectively selected. In other words, it continues to be more select. From all of humanity, we get, you know, Noah, and then from Noah, we get another sort of breath of humanity, the 70 nations, but we ultimately fix on Shem, who's the ancestor of Abraham. Abraham himself has at least two major children, progenitors, and then we have a selection of one, and usually, of course, it's the younger over the older, the younger over the older gets chosen. Yitzhak himself has two children, Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov is chosen. Then finally, with Yaakov, we begin to expand from a family to a clan, right? 12 tribes, the Shiftei Kah. And then Shemos begins the movement, the evolution from a clan to a nation that first is in another nation, in Egypt, and then is liberated from that larger dominating nation. So you essentially have the movement from a family to a nation. And just like in Sefer Bereishis, Abraham is the progenitor, is the Av, he's the father of the family, he's the pater familias. Now Abraham, it's very interesting, what do we know about Abraham before his calling by Kadosh Baruch Hu in Parshas Lech Lecha? How do you even know that? There are a few psukim at the end of Parshas Noach that talk about him leaving from Aram, right, to going to Aram Naharaim. But we really don't know much about Avram from psukim in Tanakh, from pshat in Tanakh. We do know Chazal and the entire Masorah treat Avram in certain typological or archetypal images. He's the martyr. He's thrown into the Kifshan Ha'esh at a young age, and he becomes the martyr who basically, through his martyrdom or near martyrdom, is able to rally many people behind him. He's also the philosopher, according to the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchas Avodas Chachamim. The Avraham Avinu is the first philosopher. He realizes the existence of God through reason, through rationality, through arguments about the existence of God. And perhaps most famously, Abraham is the iconoclast, right? He's literally the smasher of idols of his father Terach's home or shop of idols. So Chazal paint a very rich portrait of Abraham Avinu, but in terms of actual psukim, of terms of actual history in Torah, we get very, very little. In contrast to that, in contrast to Abraham, the theological, you know, progenitor, or the progenitor of the family that's connected to the divine, to God, to the Inyan Eloki, as Rabbi Yehuda Levi in the Kuzari calls it. In contrast to that image, which has no prehistory, or a mysterious prehistory, Moshe Rabbeinu, the leader of the political entity known as, you know, Bnei Yisrael in Sefer Shmos, does have a prehistory. Because before Moshe is called by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when is Moshe called by HaKadosh Baruch Hu? He's not called by HaKadosh Baruch Hu until Perek Gimel. His vocation at Har Sinai, at Har Chorev, the Sneh, doesn't take place until Perek Gimel. We have two prakim of a prehistory of Moshe, and one Perek Beis, which is really a history, if you will, in miniature, of Moshe Rabbeinu's youth and young adult life. Okay? Now, let's take a look and see the key episodes in this political portrait that I'd like to paint for you of Moshe's early life and his youth. So the first Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayehi Vayomer Ha'em V'Yigdal Moshe, right? In those days, Moses grew. Now, I should have included Pasuk Yud, right? Mrs. Stahl, can you read it? Pasuk Yud? What does Pasuk Yud say? Okay, so this pasuk, thank you. This is the climactic pasuk in the entire birth narrative of Moshe Rabbeinu, which we all know from, you know, from our youth, from cheder, from elementary school, from the Ten Commandments, whatever your point of reference is, you know this story of Moshe being rescued, being put into the bulrushes. But it says at the end there, what? V'yigdal Moshe, that he grows up, right? So what's the problem with the very next pasuk that V'yigdal Yeled, that the child grows up? The very next pasuk Yud Aleph, where we begin here, it says V'yigdal Moshe. So right away Rashi points to the obvious question, well, he grew up there, he grew up here, what's the difference? And Rashi says, one is for koma, one is for physical stature or physical, you know, maturation, and one is for gedulah. One is for in some sense royalty. Rashi says he was appointed at this, in this narrative, he was appointed as the viceroy, or the one to lead the base paro. So there's a difference between the chronological age that we already learned a pasuk earlier, and some coming of age here, which is not just chronological, but has something to do with politics, according to Rashi, that he becomes, he literally, Dasheni Ligdula Sheminuhu Paro al Beito, that Paro appoints Moshe at this time over his household, over his affairs. Chazal are divided. How old was Moshe at this very point, right, when it says Vayhi Bayimim Ahem Vigdal Moshe? One opinion says he was 20, and one opinion says he was 40. I don't know how much hangs in the balance between those two opinions, but certainly, like we have a debate by Avram Avinu in an interesting parallel, how old was Avram Avinu when he discovered God? Was he 8? Was he 80? Was he 75? So too with Moshe, we have a little bit of a debate. But what's key here is this is not a chronological matter. This is not just a matter of actual aging, but this is a matter of political standing. And I'm going to argue that it's the culmination of a kind of education that Moshe received. Because what happens? He goes out to his brethren, Vayar b'siblosam, that he sees them in their suffering. Rashi, quoting Chazal, says, Nasan ena b'libo lios meitzar alehem. That there was some kind of empathy that Moshe Rabbeinu had at this moment when he sees his brethren suffering. It was not just that he physically saw them, Vayar, that he saw them empirically, he was able to witness these crimes, but there was something within Moshe's personality which, for the first time apparently, created a sense of empathy and a sense of solidarity. So what's the source of this solidarity? What's the source of this empathy? So I want to show you a very interesting section from Philo's The Life of Moses. Philo, as many of you know, I'm sure, was an Alexandrian Jew. He lived roughly in the time of Hillel HaZaken. He was a younger contemporary of Hillel HaZaken. He lived from around 40 BCE, 40 before the Common Era, to around 50 of the Common Era. We don't know much about Philo, his own life. The only thing that we know, his only connection with Judaism that's historically verifiable, is that he, if you believe his own testimonies, that he was Ola L'Regel once in his lifetime from Alexandria to Yerushalayim. A lot of scholars are divided whether he even knew Hebrew or Aramaic. He was a Greek-speaking Jew, and apparently he was a Baal Tshuva of some sorts. He was raised in a Jewish Alexandrian home, but a very secular, very Greek home. But he quickly became very committed to Judaism, to the tradition of Judaism and Torah and Mosaic law, what he called Mosaic law. And he is one of the first thinkers to attribute Moshe as the ancestor or the teacher of certain Greek thinkers, Greek philosophers, Greek lawgivers. So Philo, for example, believes that Moshe was the teacher of Pythagoras, which chronologically does not fit. But it's what Philo says, that he was the teacher of Herodotus, the Greek historian. These things historically really are not valid, but conceptually, Philo is trying to trace Greek wisdom and Greek excellence back to Judaism. And this was a tradition that actually stretches well into the medieval period. You find Rabbi Yehuda Halevi of the Kuzari also suggests that philosophy has Jewish origins. There's even a Chazal that Alexander the Great met Shimon HaTzadik, and there was an encounter there. Rav Tzadok HaKohen in Lublin, the great Hasidic, the 19th century Hasidic thinker, thinks that this meeting between between Alexander of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, and Shimon HaTzadik has some philosophical implications. But be that as it may, the interesting thing what Philo does is he turns Moshe into a philosopher. Now this is not a strange thing if you think about it. He was enamored both with Greek philosophy, he used to call Plato the holy Plato, and he was enamored with Judaism. He believed that Torah was the divine law. So he attempted to reconcile. It was really the first time in Western history where there was an attempted synthesis between faith and philosophy, between reason and revelation, which is a problem that we today, even in the 21st century, can come back to the debates or the challenges between reason and revelation, between philosophy and religion. But look what he says about Moshe. This is one of his treatises called The Life of Moses. So just look how he begins. I've conceived the idea of writing the life of Moses, who according to the account of some persons was the lawgiver of the Jews, but according to others only an interpreter of the sacred laws, the greatest and most perfect man that ever lived, having a desire to make his character fully known to those who ought not to remain in ignorance respecting him. For him, making Moshe into this great figure, equal or surpassing the Greek lives, there's a whole genre of writing that would write histories of the great Greek generals, the great Greek poets, the great Greek philosophers. What Philo did was he took that genre and he applied it to Moshe Rabbeinu to try to elevate Moshe in the eyes of the Greeks, who thought that Judaism was a bit of a gutter religion. They didn't think that Judaism was an elevated way of life. They saw it as superstitious. They saw it, and there were actually riots and pogroms in Alexandria of the Greeks killing the Jews in Alexandria, that Philo actually goes to Rome to defend the Jews of Alexandria. But look, from a literary or conceptual point of view, he's trying to show that Moshe Rabbeinu was this great figure that we can accept, of course, but that it was based on the fact that he wrote laws or was the interpreter of the sacred laws, and that the glory of the laws which he left behind him has reached over the whole world and has penetrated to the very furthest limits of the universe. So that he's saying Judaism has a powerful legacy that the whole world should be serious about. But then look what he does about Moshe's own life, to the part of Moshe's life that we are actually looking at right now. Turn the page, look at it says Roman numeral 5:20. Therefore, the child, being now thought worthy of a royal education and a royal attendance, was not like a mere child, long delighted with toys and objects of laughter and amusement, even though those who had undertaken the care of him allowed him holidays and times for relaxation. That's good, very progressive there. And never behaved in any stern or morose way to him. But he himself exhibited a modest and dignified deportment in all his words and gestures, attending diligently to every lesson of every kind which could tend to the improvement of his mind. They had to hire Greek tutors, because the Egyptian tutors weren't good enough. But in short time he surpassed all their knowledge, anticipating all their lessons by the excellent natural endowments of his own genius. So that everything in his case appeared to be e-collecting, in other words, remembering, rather than learning. This is a reference to a Platonic idea that when we learn, we're not learning something new, we're actually excavating or remembering something that is already in our souls, mimesis. We're just bringing it out. It's already in there, which is, of course, reminiscent of the Chazal, that the angels teach you Torah before you're born and then give you a little snack here. That sounds very much like the Platonic theory of recollection, maybe. But at any rate, so look at this picture of Moshe. So he's got this well-disposed soul. He's going forward to meet the lessons which are imparted. What is he studying? He speedily learned arithmetic, geometry, the whole science of rhythm and harmony and meter. He's a Renaissance man. And the whole of music, by means of the use of musical instruments and by lectures on the different arts and by explanations of each topic and lessons on these subjects were given him by Egyptian philosophers, who also taught him the philosophy which is contained in symbols, hieroglyphics, the theology of the Egyptians. The Greeks are teaching him. Turn the page, 32. But Moses, having now reached the very highest point of human good fortune and being looked upon as the grandson of this mighty king and being almost considered in the expectations of all men as the future inheritor of his grandfather's kingdom. And the idea of a grandfather is interesting. This is the Pharisees like the Ten Commandments. That's where they got it from. I'm not joking. If you look at the end of the Ten Commandments, it actually says that some of this was taken from Philo, Eusebius, one of the church fathers. This is the idea that Seti was the grandfather of the father of Ramses, and that he was the adopted daughter of Bithya, who is the daughter of Seti, not the wife of Paro that we know. So he was going to inherit the kingdom. But what happened, and being always addressed as the young prince, the prince of Egypt, still felt a desire for and admiration of the education of his kinsmen and ancestors. Despite the fact that he was the the prince of Egypt with all this education, a world-class education, the liberal arts, the trivium, the quadrivium, all the highest forms of science of his day. Nevertheless, he still felt a desire for an admiration of the education of his kinsmen and ancestors, the Hebrews, considering all the things which were thought good among those who had adopted him as spurious. He really knew that what the Egyptians stood for was worthless. Even though he valued the education, he was able to use that education. But he himself knew that what his Jewish parents, his real ancestry, had was the real treasure. And the Egyptians were only an outer or brilliant appearance from the outside. And those things which were thought good by his natural parents, Amram and Yocheved, even though they might be for a short time somewhat obscure, they were hidden, they were covered, they were in a low point in Jewish history, at all events akin to himself and genuine good things. Okay, this is Philo. Fascinating. Sort of Moshe Rabbeinu as the philosopher king, Moshe Rabbeinu as the educated master of Egypt. If you think this is just a Philonic or a Greek interpolation on Moshe Rabbeinu's pristine Jewish life, take a look at the next Marimukum, the Ibn Ezra. This is Ibn Ezra in his Perish Aruch and his longer commentary on Shmos Perek Beis. And look what he says. Ulai sidev Hashem zeh shegidel Moshe bebeis hamalkus, that perhaps God caused this phenomena. You shouldn't think that this just happened, that this was just a happenstance or natural course of things, but rather maybe God in his providence and wisdom was able to orchestrate that Moshe would be brought up in the Beis Hamalkus. Why? Lios nafsho amadrega elyona b'derech halimud v'haregilus, in order that Moshe's character would be on a high plane, a high standing in limud, in education, and regilus, in habit or character, habituation, his virtues. In other words, that he would be not just intellectually impressive, but he would be morally impressive. What does that mean? That seems to be the opposite of what Philo said, right? Philo said that Moshe knew that the Egyptians were really spurious, it was nonsense, and what the Jews had to teach was very important. Ibn Ezra seems to be saying something slightly different. And so that he not become lowly and sort of ordinary. Lios beveis avadim, that he would be in the house of slaves. What does that mean? What do you think Ibn Ezra is suggesting here, as opposed to Philo? What's the virtue that Philo identifies that Moshe had, mainly in the piece that we read? Pardon? What are the things that Moshe acquires through his education in Egypt?
His abilities. So the Jewish people as the conjurers.
Okay, there is an element of the conjurers at the very end, but what does he actually study in Egypt according to Philo? He studies all the disciplines, all the sciences of the day, all the intellectual fields of the day. He essentially becomes educated at the highest level of government, at the highest level of scholarship. That's not what the Ibn Ezra is focusing on. What does the Ibn Ezra focus on? Not the intellectual virtue, but what? The character, the moral virtue. In other words, he says that Moshe had to be raised in Beis Paro because by being raised in the royal house, in the house of the king, of the Pharaoh, you get a sense of moral, righteous indignation. You get the sense of what's right and wrong. This is beneath what there's a natural tendency for those raised in royalty, the aristocracy, according to Ibn Ezra, of seeing right and wrong in a very powerful way. That they can have a sense of justice or a sense of even righteous indignation that an injustice is being committed. They can't stand that. Had Moshe been raised in the Jewish slavery, Ibn Ezra suggests, he wouldn't have been sensitive to it. He would have just been another slave. He would have been caught in the masses. He would have been, you know, crushed under the weight of all this slavery. He wouldn't have had this morally pristine character. He would have been just a cog in a machine. But according to Ibn Ezra, the fact that he was actually raised in Beis Paro gives him the chance to see things with an elevated stature and posture.
It's
a sense that there's a patch, the sort of the white man's burden, to use a very un-PC term, that the royalty has to take responsibility for what's right and what's just, because the masses won't do it. This is an old vision of, this is what the founding fathers believed, that you're born into a certain aristocracy, or you're born in, I mean, Hamilton wasn't born in the aristocracy, he was born in the Caribbean, and he was born of a bastard, he went to a yeshiva, believe it or not, because no school would take him. This is not all true about Hamilton, but Washington, Madison, Jefferson, these were patricians. That's the patrician impulse that Kennedy had, does have an impact on how you see the world.
That explains the puzzle. The Pusik says, oh, he grew up.
Right, exactly.
And he sees injustice being done.
Exactly. He grew up, meaning he was educated to be conditioned to see that, to notice that. It wasn't that he just got older. That's easy. That's chronological. Yes, his mother weaned him, the Bas power weaned him. But the second is for elevation. It's not just that he was put over Parra's house. There was a reason why he was put over Parra's house. Okay, let's move a little further.
It's also
Vayetze. Right, well, Vayetze El that he goes... He goes out of the domain of Paro into the world of his brethren, right? So, Halotireh Shaharag Mitzri. We're back in the Ibn Ezra inside that we see that he killed the Mitzri Ba'avurshu Asa Hamas. That the Egyptian did Hamas an injustice, a terrible avla. He killed him because of the injustice, not because he was a Jew. That's another very very wonderful Nechama Leibowitz. That if you look at the three episodes that happened, that we actually have this history of Moshe Rabbeinu in this perek. What's the first episode? This episode of the Mitzri killing the Jew, Moshe reacting. What's the second episode? What was the second thing that we learned? Go back to your psukim here. Vayetzei b'yom hasheni, he went out again, and what is it? He meets the two Jews fighting, right? Some of the Chazal say Dasan Ambira. What? Two Jews fighting. And the third, what happens the third, later on in the Psukim, he flees to Midian, and he finds what? The daughters of Yitro are being oppressed by these Roim. And he defends the women, he defends the daughters of Yitro against these shepherds who are encroaching on their wells. Nechama Leibowitz has a beautiful Ha'ara. She says that in each stage, you see another form of justice. The first is the lowest form. It's you're defending your own people. From a point of view of nationality or particularism, that's the highest form, right? But from the point of view of justice, which aspires to some universal level, some objective level, that's the most basic. You're going to defend those who you love, your own flesh and blood. That's solidarity. Especially when it's who? It's a Mitzri attacking a Jew. So you're going to defend the Jew against the Mitzri. That's the first level of justice. It's still a level of justice, but it's the lowest level. What's the second level? Two Jews. There's no sense of your solidarity. You're defending against a non-Jew, the other against a Jew. You're trying to establish who's right between two equals, two Jews who are peers, essentially, to one another. But you still have a claim, a stake in it, because they're Jews, right? You still care. They're Jews. It's not a Gentile versus a Jew. It's two Jews. In the third case, they're not Jewish. Neither party is Jewish. Moshe has no dog in this race. He's got no bone to pick here. And yet he inserts himself because he cares about justice. He cares about this political ideal. And again, I say political on purpose. It's this ideal of justice, how to order society, what's good for society, what's best for the community, not just what's great for my party, what I need. So let's quickly, we'll see. Look at the last line in the Ibn Ezra. Right? And he goes on to say, similar to what we just said, that Nechama says, Voshia benos Midian meharoim. He doesn't pick up the difference between the Jew and the non-Jew as much as Nechama does. But Voshia benos Midian meharoim, Babur shahayu osim chamas lahashko sonon mehamayim shadalu, that they were trying to take the water that they had, the Roim were taking the water from what they had, the women had dug out. That was no good, also injustice. But O Davar Acher, ki ilu haya gidel ben echav, had Moshe been brought up amongst his own brothers, the Jewish slaves, v'yaki ruhu minu urav, and they recognized him from his youth, lo hayu yirei mimenu, they wouldn't fear him at all, they wouldn't be machshav him, ki yachshavuhu ke echav, they would just say, oh, he's another Jew, he's going to do nothing for us. It's like the idea of Ein Navi Be'iro, that we don't take the people that are closest with us so seriously. You know, sometimes a school, they won't look within the school to hire a successor to the principal. They'll find, oh, some great, you know, great principal from some other community, because, you know, the guy, everybody knows the second guy, you know, he's come up through the ranks, or, you know, we've seen him in shul grow up. You know, it works both ways. The truth is, some people like that. It's a nice story. There's a kind of literary, you know, beauty to that, the homegrown talent. But there is an idea of Ein Navi Be'iro, and that's what essentially Ibn Ezra is saying here. Okay, look at the Malbim. Look at the Malbim, says something very similar, right? When Moshe goes out to the other brother, to the second story here in our narrative of the Shnei Nashim Nitzim, right? What happens? Va'avshara Tzaretz Echav. That he saw the pain of his brethren, and he actually killed the Egyptian. He was in danger. He had killed the Mitzri. He was now a wanted man. And nevertheless, what happens? Despite the fact that he was a wanted man, he went out on the second day and he saw the two Jews fighting, and he intervened. But Yomer la Rasha, he says to the Rasha, Lama takhe reecha, at the end of the line there, Kishnei reim shehem b'matzor b'matzor yavu zelazeh. The natural state of two people that are both, they're both being oppressed, they're both the victims of evil. What's the natural state? Misery loves company, or solidarity. They should be loving one another. Why are they fighting each other? Why are they killing each other? So Moshe said, there's something wrong here. But that people that are they should be natural allies, these two men. They're suffering under Matzor and Matzok. Yehavu Zelazeb, Teva, in their name, but naturally they should love one another. The Yazru Zelazeb, they should help one another. Moshi Yariv Umadon Beinem, there shouldn't be a fight and a dispute between the two of them. Uvezeh, Nodesh, Natua Benafsho, Abbas Mishpat Tzedek. By this act of Moshe going out on the second day, the first day was just solidarity. This is justice. And by this we see planted within the soul, the very soul of Moshe Rabbeinu, is a love of justice and righteousness between man and man. That this quality of justice is the most essential quality for leading a nation. That the idea of justice is the essential virtue of the politician, the essential virtue of the political leader. Okay, let's finish up quickly. Let's turn to the last page. And we see this theme of political leadership in two modern posts, in two modern Mefarshim, in the Nitziv, Ha'emek Davar, right? Beif and Kovacho, that he, Moshe, looked this way and that way. So what does he say? Chipes Esos Likvol Al-Mitzri Sheiku Chinam. He looked to indict, he was trying to find ways to indict the Mitzri that hit the Jew for nothing. V'yarkin Ein Ish, and he saw that there was no man. L'hagid L'funav Esa Avel. There was no one to tell of this terrible crime. There was no one to report this crime to, that this Egyptian taskmaster beat this Jew to senseless to death, perhaps for no reason. Kikulam, cause all of them, Atzeres Bogdim, they're traitors, Besone Yisrael, and haters of the Jews. Who is Moshe appealing to in this parish, according to the Nitziv? Who is Moshe trying to find reasons and indicting, and who didn't he find? Egyptians. There were no good Egyptians. There were no Egyptians that he could go and say, the law is broken, this man, this slave, yes, he's a slave, but you can't just beat him for nothing. There were no Egyptians that he could tell the tale of injustice, because the Egyptians, the very fact that this taskmaster existed proved that the entire nation of Egypt had lost its moral footing. It had lost its moral moorings, and it could not be trusted to execute justice any longer. So what does Moshe do? The Yachas of Mitzri. Moshe himself takes it upon himself. But Mokhin Shein Anoshim Hishtadil Hu Lios Ish. This is a very famous mission in Avos. In the place where there are no men of stature, not gender or you know, stature, physical, there's no hero, there's no one who's going to stand up for what's right and wrong, you need to do the justice yourself. You need to act. You need to take action. Very interestingly, the Ksava HaKabbalah, Rav Zvi Mecklenburg, has a similar insight, but a different sort of focus. Who's he talking about? Even Kovacho, that Moshe looked this way and that way. That Who is he really going to, who is he trying to appeal to? His fellow Jews. Jews, you guys, what's going on? This mystery is killing your brother. You're doing nothing. That's unfortunately, but Yarkeinish, there was no Rosh Ein Beinayim Gever Megubrin. There was no hero. There was no one to stand up against this injustice. This was the slave mentality. There was an apathy of years born of slavery, of being beaten down. The Jews could not defend their own brother or sister. They couldn't do it. They were smacked down. They were crushed. This required Moshe to rise up and act as the savior through justice, which was the beginning of his political education. I think, in conclusion, we can really move, if you will, from the political to the psychological. Because we've been discussing all the ways in which Moshe's political education, his education intellectually, like Philo, his education morally, like the Ibn Ezra, all led to create a certain character, a certain personality. But if you think about this, this personality that Moshe had was very complex. Think about, he was the prince of Egypt, right? He was this son raised in royalty, like Ibn Ezra says. He had a sense of moral indignation, moral righteousness. He was a son of the Pharaoh. The world rises and falls with the Pharaoh. And yet he was born of slaves. He was born to Amram Yechabit. He was a son of slaves. This created a tremendous tension, a tremendous complex view of who I am, what's my identity. Very interesting, Jonathan Sacks points out that the first words that we hear from Moshe in an actual dialogue with another human being, where there's a real conversation, not another human being, actually, the first dialogue is with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the first two words that Moshe says is, Mi Anofi, who am I? He says, who am I to lead, you know, your children out of Egypt? I'm nothing. He was the unof. He couldn't see himself in that role. But Jonathan Sacks points, shows that there was an identity crisis here. Mi Anochi, who am I? And it makes sense. Who was he? Was he the son of slaves? Or was he the prince of Egypt? I want to suggest, V'yifan ko v'cho v'yar ki ein ish. This is Alpi Drush. So don't quote me as saying that this is a shot in any way. But V'yifan ko v'cho, he looked this way and that way. He looked at his Egyptian education. He looked at his being raised in the royal household. V'yifan ko v'cho, he looked that he was a son of slaves. V'yar ki ein ish. He saw that he wasn't a whole coherent individual. He was confused. He was conflicted. V'yach es ha-mitzri. In the one act of slaying this Egyptian, he slays the Egyptian side of his personality. He subsumes that under the whole, the sands of his mind, the soul, the psyche, the different layers of his personality. And he chooses, by killing the Egyptian, he chooses a side. Now, a few psukim later, the daughters of Yitro say they found who? An ish mitzri hitziluni. That a Egyptian saves us. So he hasn't shed his Egyptian identity, and in fact, he needs that Egyptian identity, according to Ibn Ezra. He needs that sense of righteous indignation. He needs the education of the philosopher, of the scientist, of the engineer that Philo discusses to raise the Jews out of Egypt. But it's a very tough role. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks him to tell the Jews to take the Kesef and the Zahav and the Yinatzlus Mitzrayim to despoil Egypt, according to many, the Kesef and the Zahav is actually Tzadok HaKohen, the mentor of Tzadok. It's not physical gold and silver. It's the wisdom of Egypt. That the Jews should take the wisdom of Egypt out. But that's very hard for Moshe to do. Because Moshe came from that, and he had to get rid of that to be Moshe. And that's why Hashem says, Daber Na. Na is always a Lashon Bakasha. It's always a Lashon of, please do this. This is not easy for Moshe. Another person, he could take out the gold and silver from Egypt. Moshe, who had it and left it, very hard to do. But sometimes we have to make those choices. Thankfully, we live in a world, Baruch Hashem, where we can learn together, New Year's Eve, not New Year's Eve, we can do, you know, Kodesh and Chol. We don't always have to choose the Yachas and Mitzri, but sometimes we do have to choose. Have a wonderful Shabbos, everybody. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. This counts as 2 and 3. So now we have 3. Next, we have January is a lighter.